and I'm doing a story about the Highway 37 corridor and how the transmission line and new development along that corridor of the highway is going to affect the Iskut as a community.
Okay.
And we had talked last year. You had suggested that some sort of contingency fund might be created out of profits, and that would have a benefit just beyond creating temporary jobs. And is this an approach that that's been done elsewhere in the world, to your knowledge, or precedent?
Well, I mean, I think there is precedent in other countries. I mean, the whole question is whether or not Indigenous people or First Nations should be partners in the economic activity within their territory, and I think most Canadians would agree that they should be. And typically, in the past, these various agreements, while progressive compared to what happened 100 years ago or 50 years ago, are nevertheless still trivial compared to what one might expect. You know, I mean, you take something like Eskay Creek, which is actually a very environmentally sound mine, but it generated literally billions of dollars worth of value from the gold, and 10, 15 years later, it's all dried up and gone away, and Iskut has no more infrastructure than it did the day the mine started, and that just seems wrong to me. And when I met with the premier, I mentioned that, and I showed a photograph of a close friend of mine whose family had endured unspeakable tragedies in the previous 5 years. I mean, one suicide, one death by malpractice, another dubious death, another accidental death. I mean, the litany was astonishing.
Yeah.
And in that same period of time, I cited to the premier how much value had come out of the territory, and I asked the obvious question: why don't the kids of Iskut have a swimming pool? Why don't they have a hockey rink? Why don't they have an elders center? Why don't they have all of the infrastructure that communities and families along the Yellowhead Highway, for example, take for granted?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important issue. And the thing that I think is most disturbing about the expansion of the Stuart Cassiar, I mean, you know, the whole northwest quadrant of the province has been subject to ebbs and flows of development pressure that have sort of often come and gone overnight, you know, whether it was the attempt to quadruple the annual allowable cut in the boreal forest of northwest British Columbia in the mid-90s, or whether it was the effort to dam the Sakin in the 70s with five major dams, or the dream of development embodied by the extension of the BC Rail from Fort St. James to the arbitrary destination of Dease Lake, built at a cost of over $1 billion in the early 70s, with not a mile of track laid. And now, of course, the latest pressure are these various resource extraction proposals. I mean, the coal bed methane at the headwaters of the three major salmon rivers of the northwest, an open pit copper and gold mine on the flanks of Todigan Mountain, home to the highest population of stone sheep in the world. You know, projects which are virtually universally opposed by the Iskut community. I mean, recently there was a meeting between Imperial Metals, which is pushing this proposal on Todigan Mountain, and in Iskut, and only a single person, according to my friends, only a single person in the entire community stood up in favor of the project. And yet, ironically, the project, I mean, there are 4,000 copper mines in the world. We don't need another one, and we certainly don't need one on top of a mountain that is not only the home to the highest population of stone sheep, but it's also the epicenter of an area that certainly equals Yosemite or Banff in terms of its natural values and its potential as a destination for high-end international travel and tourism. I mean, to put that in perspective, the tourism and travel industry is a $4.5 trillion industry. The entire market the total market capitalization of every mining company in the world is less than $1 trillion, about $967 billion. And $1 billion, again, to put that in perspective, is a pile of $1,000 banknotes, roughly 348 feet high, and $1 trillion is a pile of $1,000 banknotes stacked up roughly 67 miles high. So the scale in terms of the valuation of the landscape should be obvious to people. I mean, there are lots of great places to put mines, and then most of the community in the Northwest has been very much in favor, for example, of the Galore Creek development, because it's a mine of some longevity, isolated from communities, with few ecological challenges and capacity to employ everybody who needs a job for 40 years.
Yeah.
No one's against mines. The question is, there's certain, you don't drill for oil in the Sistine Chapel. And the reason to oppose the Red Chris mine is not only its situation close to the community of Iskut, but its situation at the epicenter of the Headwater Lake chain that, by all kind of assessment, would be the epicenter of this region if and when, and not when, but really if, I'm not, I'm saying not if, but when, it begins to get recognized for its world-class values. I mean, one of the things that's so difficult in Canada is that the country still has a sort of mythos of the north, of the hinterland, of the wild, and yet no one really chooses ever to go there. I mean, we're the most thoroughly urban society probably imaginable. And I was shocked when I met the premier, for example, to find that he had never been to a quarter of the province.
When had you talked to him, when you were referring to?
You know, I can't put a date to it. It was David Suzuki arranged a meeting, and David and I went and met with Premier Campbell, who was perfectly cordial.
Yeah. Was it like last year?
It was, well, not last year. But, I mean, he was perfectly cordial, but he just mentioned that he had never been north of the Yellowhead Highway, and I think that's one of the problems. I mean, I was in a neighboring lodge and overheard this conversation by chance. Two very pleasant people, you know, who had just come down from this site of the Red Chris mine, but the conversation sort of went like, oh, wow, did you see? No, wow, I've never seen such a beautiful place. The wildlife, yeah, I've never seen so many sheep, but there are more wildlife. I've never seen any. You ever been up here? No, me, never north of Prince George. How about you? No, I've never even been as far as Williams Lake. Well, of course, it turns out to be a conversation between the engineer from, it was either BC Metals or Imperial Metals. I can't remember when it happened, whether that, you know, Imperial had bought the project or not. And then the other was the assistant deputy minister of mines. You know, so here they were waxing eloquent about a place that it was their bureaucratic and corporate mission to destroy.
Yeah.
And the disconnect was just profound. And so how would Canadians feel, for example, to know that this mine, which is, it reminds me of the Glen Canyon, you know, the famous canyon that nobody knew, and when David Brower of the Sierra Club cut the deal to save the Grand Canyon but sacrificing the Glen Canyon, and we suddenly realized it was an incredibly jewel of a place that no one ever saw, and that's what I fear is going to happen to the Stikine, because Canadians have never been to the place that is about to be destroyed. I mean, here you're talking about an area, you know, where John Muir calls just the Lord Stikine, a Yosemite 150 miles long, and,
yeah,
you know, the Grand Canyon of the Colorado is 27,000 people go through it by raft every year, 5 million people visit it. Yosemite has more people visited every year than the entire population of Los Angeles, and there's 23,000 criminal arrests in the valley 7 miles square. And here in Canada, we have, you know, the Grand Canyon of Stikine and all its history. No rafts made it, and less than 100 people have ever gotten through it, and yet most Canadians couldn't even put it on a map or even name the place. Yet for world-class kayakers, it's known as the ultimate K2 of whitewater kayaking. And so, you know, it's just so frustrating that this is all happening. And by all accounts, for example, the mine, the Red Chris mine, can only go ahead if it gets subsidized power. And so what is the federal government doing on it's spending $135 million of your tax money that, coming out of the Green Fund, which was set aside to help transform the Canadian economy away from carbon, and on the excuse that this power line is going to get the community of Iskut, a town of 300 people, off its diesel-generating, diesel-run generators, and technically reduce its localized carbon footprint. That's given the government the excuse to subsidize a $135 million transmission line, all of which is designed, of course, to bring subsidized power to this mine.
Yeah.
And how would Canadians feel to know that their green funds that have a great fanfare been announced as a government's commitment to weaning the country from carbon or reducing our carbon footprint as a nation, to realize that that money has actually been used to grind up the most beautiful mountain in British Columbia and home to the biggest population of stone sheep in the world. I mean, it's the most cynical manipulation of public funds that I can think of in the history of Canada.
Now, you had mentioned as far as, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that, that it is inevitable that people will discover the Stikine watershed, maybe not in time, but you had talked about how changing the designation of Spetsesi, for example, trying to find ways to maximize.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I did some guiding last summer for my old friend Ray Collingwood, who's the outfitter, whose territory includes the Spetsesi Park. And, we had six Canadians, all from the Lower Mainland, all extraordinarily sophisticated travelers. I mean, affluent and but well traveled. There was almost nowhere they had never been except their own province, and they were just slack-jawed at the beauty of the place. And I do an enormous amount of work, in effect, in the travel industry because I design trips for the National Geographic, and I travel as many as 30 countries a year, and the key to that whole high-end travel business is the fact that everybody can essentially go anywhere on Earth within 24 hours. And so if you're going to have a high-end destination, you have to be prepared to compete with the possibility of going to Tibet or Antarctica or anywhere else.
Yeah.
And in a way that really frustrates me as a proud Canadian, we don't seem to have that ability to recognize that our own landscape in every single way qualifies in that elite series of possible destinations. So, I mean, for example, the six people that I guided were absolutely just astonished by what they saw and thought it was the most beautiful place they'd ever been. And yet it was only by chance, in a sense, that they decided to go there because I was leading a trip. And if we could only get more Canadians to see the wonder of what we have, in the lower 48, the farthest you can get away from a maintained road is 20 miles. There's not a single river that flows more than 1,000 kilometers without a dam. I mean, we have this incredible jewel of a place. And I'm all in favor of thoughtful economic development, and I'm actually in favor of mines because, if they've done well, they have a relatively modest ecological footprint. It's not being about all mines, it's about against this mine that is just the wrong mine in the wrong place. And not simply because of one's concern about the environment, but in purely economic terms, why on earth would you compromise? I mean, if you put an open-pit copper and gold mine processing 30,000 tons of rock a day, and perhaps more, in the epicenter of the lake chain that could be the equivalent of a national park headquarters, you're dooming for all time the possibility of that eventuality, right?
Right.
And for what reason? So that a mid-level mining company that's desperate because their only other property they're running out of ore, a company that's desperate to move its operation from Huckleberry Mine, they want to mine anywhere because they've got all this infrastructure to move, and that's what they do. They make open pit mines, but I don't see why all of Canadians should effectively suffer, or that this landscape should suffer, so that this mid-level company can generate 200 jobs for 20 years.
Okay.
And of course, the question is jobs for who? I mean, if people actually think that the Imperial Metal is going to be running a training program to train people from ISKID when they've got an entire cadre of personnel that they're going to be presumably having to find work for from the Huckleberry experience, I don't see how the local people are going to benefit. I can't speak for the local people, but when they speak for themselves, they clearly don't think they're going to benefit either.
A fundamental fundamental conflict seems to be that mining companies will try to push everything ahead as quickly as possible, while local people might want a more orderly pace, protect environment, maximize jobs.
Well, that's a classic case. You put seven mines in one generation, or one mine to seven generations. I think it's the nature of the mining business that is speculative, that it's stock-driven, that it, therefore it's based on hyperbole and generating excitement about potential discoveries. Once a mine has potential to become developed, the companies have every incentive to create an aura of inevitability. And that's exactly what Imperial has done. At every single step of the way, they have pushed the envelope. So when given, for example, permission to build an exploratory track up the mountain without any kind of government oversight whatsoever, they simply plowed a road right up the mountain.
Yeah,
and
right by your place, I've seen that.
Right, when a group of a coalition of people took the government to court, challenging whether or not the proper environmental procedures had been undertaken, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the suit, and saying that the government indeed had failed to do its proper due diligence, and in the future it would have to in any mining project in British Columbia or in Canada for that matter. But then in this kind of bizarre Canadian way, it compromised by recusing Vickers having to follow those very procedures.
Yeah, right.
How many Canadians would support that as a concept of free, a fair play or whatever, And right now, for example, Imperial, even though the power line upon which they, by their own admission, has not been approved, it'll be at least two or three years before it will go through. It's got to go through its own environmental assessment process and so on. They're talking already about beginning to clear the topsoil from the mine site as if it was a done deal. And I find it kind of extraordinary. If I treated, I took a small piece of land on Elu Lake, our place there, took it when the government made the leases available for purchase, and I had 7 years of environmental due diligence and the contract by which I bought that 7 acres of land stipulated with great specificity what I could and could not do to that land. I'm not allowed to take down a single tree that does not threaten a structure. Now, how is it that the government can, in a sense, demand that kind of due diligence from a civilian, and yet tolerate a company just plowing ahead? I just find it astonishing, and it really is just egregious. If Canadians knew what was being sacrificed for the sake of the well-being of this tiny little company, I think they'd be appalled.
Wait, I was wondering if you might tell me a little bit about the book project you're doing. I know that Tony Colangelo is involved.
Paul.
Oh, sorry, Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things we're trying to do is present the wonder and the beauty of this country to the Canadian people, so that at least my biggest fear is that this will all occur before Canadians even realize what it is that they're losing. And so one of the thoughts I had is why don't we produce a book that we can distribute nationally that will celebrate the land that the First Nations call the Sacred Headwaters. And so I with the help of a group called the International League of Conservation Photographers, we brought four, including Paul, and I suppose five, including myself, professional photographers up to the region this past summer, and just set them out to document the beauty of the place. And those images, the best of images taken by all photographers, not just that group, but other Canadian, British Columbian photographers who've worked in the area, we're pulling together the most beautiful images we can.
Great.
Simply to draw people's attention to this place that nobody knows.
Do you have any idea when that might be released? Or
well,
published?
I can't say for sure. I mean, it's still what we want, the text of the book. We very much hope to have it essentially be the voices of the people, native and non-native, who live in the region, and have them give voice to what they feel about this country that's so important to them.
That sounds great.
I mean, that's the other thing that, you know, I think is sort of, and it gets back to that conversation I overheard in that lodge where you know, decisions that affect these remote landscapes are made so far away by individuals who have never been there and who have no history in the place, have no connection to it, have no sense of personal narrative. In fact, I've only been living in the region and visiting the region for 35 years. I've only been a landowner there for 25 years, but my family plans to be there forever, and we will wait out the mine, and the mine will come and go. Even if they put the mine in, we'll still be there when it's gone. I'll be dead, but my children won't. And I mean, I had this moment at the beginning of the summer where my youngest daughter, who's 19, one evening took out a canoe, and it got dark, and I went out looking for her, and I found her on this high bluff where she used to go as a little girl, and she just was crying her eyes out, and I said, honey, what's wrong? And she said, oh, Daddy, it's just so beautiful. I just realized this is my home. This is the whole vortex of my life. This is where I'm going to die. This is everything to me.
Yeah.
And how do you compare that commitment to place, that sense of connection to landscape, that visceral sense of a linkage to a kind of a sacredness of place that is something that the First Nations feel reflexively because it's been in the fiber of their being all of their history. And I see that in my own children for whom that place has been their lodestone. It's been the well that the family has drawn from in all the rest of our lives. And you know, I find it just extraordinary that someone who's never been in the country can cobble together a company with less history than my dog, and just by promising some revenue flow to the government, secure the right to transform a place for their own private gain for all time. And it's even more remarkable that in the calculus that rationalizes the industrialization of the wild, there's not a single line item or a metric that takes into account the value of the land left alone or the cost to the rest of us inherent in its destruction. I mean, it's just bizarre to me the way we exploit and industrialize the landscape. And yet, you know, who's going to suffer? My children will suffer. You know, my friends in Iskut, all their kids will suffer. And the kids of the people from Imperial Metals, their kids aren't going to suffer. They're going to be buying another boat or car or another toy down in West Vancouver. Right? And that's what's going to happen.
No, I
mean, people with Imperial Metals, are they lining up to say how they're going to share revenue flows? And are they lining up to say how they're going to build a hockey rink in Iskut? Are they lining up to create trust funds so the kids from Iskut can go to university as their kids expect to go to university?